Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're always glad for your time and attention. And if you'd like to take part in our conversations on the exchange as they happen, feel free to jump in. Phone number is here, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Or you can send us an email. That address is jx@jeffnet.org. We know it's going to arrive every year. We just don't know exactly when or how big, but flu season is here, and on the Oregon size, it looks big. A report from the state shows flu or illnesses that look like the flu are high in number right now. Dozens of people spent time in hospitals in the most recent reported week. So let's talk about the numbers and the possible outlook from here. Dr. Ann Thomas is a public health physician in the acute and communicable disease section of the Oregon Public Health Division, and she's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange today. Dr. Thomas, thank you for joining us once again.
Oh, thank you for having me, Jeffrey.
So we saw the report Flu Bites from the first week of the year. In a nutshell, what are we talking about here?
Right. So the key metrics are we have this thing called influenza-like illness activity, which is high, and then the geographic spread, which is widespread. So that means it's kind of affecting, you know, most of Oregon counties. Kind of the number that is a little bit more concrete is, as you say, the percent of outpatient visits look like, you know, in patients that look like they have symptoms of influenza, which are pretty much fever and cough. And so we have a network of 20-some providers around the state who provide this information to us weekly. And so we use as a baseline sort of the percentage of people who have influenza-like illness symptoms in the off-season. And so that number, 1%, is the threshold. So all last fall, it was under 1% in our weekly report. And then, the week before Christmas, it shot up to 2%. And the week of Christmas, it was 4%. And then the week ending January 4th is up to 5%. So we were definitely on sort of a steep upslope. And 5%, it's hard to know just week to week if it's leveling off. But I'd say certainly flu activity is pretty high, and it's hitting us pretty early, as a matter of fact.
When is the usual heart of flu season then?
Well, you know, we typically say it can be any time between October and April. And I've been doing flu surveillance in Oregon since 2003. And this is the second time in that 10-year period where it's happened before February. I mean, a typical flu season for us would be influenza really starting to peak in late February or early March. And the only other time that it peaked earlier than that in my time here was in 2009 during the pandemic, where we had a very unusual, actually a late spring wave, and then in 2009, and then a big wave in early fall of 2009.
And so, Dr. Thomas, what usually accounts for the timing? I mean, what are the factors that are going to decide when a flu wave does peak?
You know, that is not really well understood. I think traditionally people just said, well, you know, kind of most respiratory illnesses sort of start to peak in the fall and into the winter because that's when it's colder and people are spending more time indoors. Scientists have looked at it more carefully, and then there are sort of arguments that have to do with sort of changes in relative humidity versus absolute humidity that sort of make the virus more able to sort of stay viable, you know, on surfaces and so forth longer. And I have to say, I can't really come up with a great answer for why. I know when I was at CDC, I had a friend who just started in the influenza division, and I asked him how his first year of flu season went. He's like, oh, yeah, you know, it's pretty busy, but I survived. But you know what they say? Once you've seen one season of flu, you've seen one season of flu. So that's sort of the hallmark of flu is really its unpredictability.
Oh, so it's the only thing that is predictable about it is that it's not predictable.
Exactly.
Got it. Well, so you indicated that weather might be a factor, and that's interesting to hear about humidity possibly playing a part here. But, I mean, if, for example, a winter is harsher and the flu is present, will more cases generally erupt, or is even that hard to predict?
I would say it has less to do with the weather than characteristics of the circulating virus. So the other interesting thing about this year is that we've seen somewhat of a resurgence of that pandemic H1N1 strain that we saw in 2009. And usually a given flu virus will sort of be around for 3 or 4 waves and then disappear because most of the population becomes immune. And with this 2009 pandemic H1N1 strain, we had a small wave in the spring of 2009, a bigger wave in the fall of 2009. And then the next 3 years since then, I was looking them up, they were all H3N2 years. So not as much activity as this virus, and apparently there's still enough of the population that's susceptible that, you know, we're seeing a big wave. And so the severity has to do typically with how many people are susceptible, which is sort of dictates how many people get it. And then the other sort of another way of looking at it is, and it's sort of separate, too. It's a separate issue, is how virulent is that particular strain. Now, we had, you know, a lot of flu in this state and a lot of hospitalizations and deaths in 2009. And in some ways, I don't think that this strain is actually more virulent than other seasonal strains. What made it such a problem was that so many people got it. So sort of like a quick example, for instance, say you have like a large high school and in an average year maybe 100 kids get the flu and 1% of them gets hospitalized. So you have one hospitalization. When you have a new flu strain, like with the pandemic, H1N1, what we saw is that just a lot more people were getting sick. So instead of maybe 100 kids in a high school getting sick, 300 or 400 getting sick, and maybe 3 or 4 of those kids getting hospitalized. So the fraction of, well, if I get the flu, what's my chance of having, you know, a severe outcome, like being sick enough to be hospitalized? That sort of fraction didn't really change, but the number of people who got sick changed. But the net result is you do end up having lots of hospitalizations, and that's somewhat what we're seeing now in the flu bites. We do have a surveillance system in the Portland Tri-County area for tracking persons who are hospitalized with flu, and those are lab-confirmed cases, not just people with symptoms of flu, so that's a pretty, you know, precise number. And that number is now up to 268. And it's hard to say how many more we'll have, but if you look at sort of the peak of it, you know, we had very little activity all last fall, and then we had about, I think, 16 hospitalizations a week before Christmas, and then 67 hospitalizations. And then the last 2 weeks in a row, we've had over 80 hospitalizations. So, again, we had that quick ramp up, and it might be leveling off, but I'd almost sort of need another week's worth of data to say that it's really leveling off. And to put it in perspective, the pandemic year we had about 500 hospitalizations in the Portland Tri-County area. And so at this point, you know, with really only sort of 4 weeks of heavy activity, we're at, you know, 268. So it's hard to say. I mean, it is looking like it's, you know, certainly going to be another heavy year for hospitalizations.
We're talking to Dr. Ann Thomas, who is a public health physician with the Acute and Communicable Disease section of the Oregon Public Health Division. We're talking about influenza. It does appear to be a bad year for flu in Oregon thus far. And we're talking about where things might go from here and what to look out for with influenza. Join us on The Exchange. You might have some stories, questions, or comments. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you were mentioning that the hospitalizations are just counted for the three metro counties, Multnomah,
right,
Clackamas,
yeah,
Washington.
Right, yeah, a lot of states don't actually even track this. It's something that we are involved in as a special project. We have funding from the Emerging Infections Program at the Centers for Disease Control. And so it's essentially a matter of convenience that, you know, there are half the population of the state is in the Portland area, and so we only have to work with, you know, 13 hospitals to sort of track what's going on each week. And in fact, the purpose of this study is really not so much to provide quick information about what's going on with flu, but more over the course of the next few months, we review all these charts and obtain the patient's vaccination histories, for instance, so we can assess the impact of vaccination that year, or look at things like the impact of antiviral. So generally, it's data that's sort of analyzed generally over the next year and used to drive policy changes about use of, you know, vaccine or antivirals, or we can, like, look at maybe new risk factors that we didn't know about, so we can, you know, especially encourage those patients to get vaccinated.
Dr. Thomas, what are the reasons that that a case of the flu will go from somebody not feeling very good at home to needing to be in the hospital?
Well, typically what we see is that the majority of people who are hospitalized have some underlying condition, and it's most common in younger persons. It's probably the culprit is usually asthma. In older persons, it has to do more with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or underlying heart disease.
All right, so they're just having greater respiratory distress than a person who's just coughing.
That's
and
most
suffering
common. Now, on a given year, again, there are otherwise healthy people who are, you know, sick enough to be hospitalized. I think it's kind of one of those things that people sort of tend to take for granted. It's like, oh, it's just flu. It's not a big deal. I don't need a flu shot. But the fact is, although the risk is highest in people that have these underlying conditions or who are very, I mean, in general, it's the rates of hospitalization in children under 2 often is as high as people over the age of 65. I think that's why we've gone from recommending flu vaccine for people just at risk to everyone. And if nothing else, it's actually school-aged children who typically sort of drive the epidemic each year that, although they have the least number of complications, they're the ones most likely to get it, and then they spread it to family members who, you know, maybe are more susceptible to developing complications from influenza.
Oh, so they're going to get it, they're going to get over it, and not have any particular troubles afterward, but they could spread it to other people in the family,
right,
who then are going to...
Yeah, so the kind of the policy of the universal vaccination is really to sort of prevent that spread to the people at higher risk.
Something you had said about the numbers this year of hospitalizations versus the pandemic year, can I guess from the numbers that you are showing this year versus the pandemic year that you could potentially see us exceeding that number? Is that the trend that the lines would indicate at this point?
Yeah, because typically you see flu, it takes a few weeks to really peak, and then you hit a peak, and then it dwindles down. You know, so, I mean, it's possible to hit those same numbers again. I think one thing that puts us ahead of, you know, puts us in a better position than in 2009 is that, you know, we didn't have a vaccine until influenza season was almost over. And this year we do have the vaccine ready. And, in fact, it's that same 2009 strain. It's been in the vaccine formulation for the last 4 years in a row. So at this point I'm still encouraging people to get vaccinated because at this point, this is a pretty well-scrutinized and well-studied vaccine, and it's been very, you know, found to be very effective and safe. And so at this point, I wouldn't be surprised to see influenza hanging around for another 6 to 8 weeks. And once you get the shot or the nasal mist, it only takes 2 weeks before it really, you know, is effective. So at this point, I would say it's not too late to get a flu shot.
Well, but, you know, I got one last year, probably about a week later into January than this, and was told, you know, you really should have gotten this in November. Is that really the optimum time to get one?
Well, you know, we don't like to have a run on vaccine, like, the week that it starts to, that activity starts to rise, just because logistically it's better to get people vaccinated, you know, as part of, like, their routine visits if they're going in for the fall or, you know, at a more convenient time than trying to rush around and go around to different pharmacies and find a place that can get it for you. In fact, you know, we think the vaccine, once you get it, probably has pretty good protective immunity for at least a year. So, since, again, and this year really shows us that, oh, wow, flu really came early. And so, since you don't know when it's going to start, probably earlier in the fall is better.
If you have had a flu shot for a couple of years running, though, are you going to be slightly better protected than somebody who just got the single flu shot this season?
It's hard to say just because, you know, the flu vaccine changes every year and what's
different
circulating
strains will be
every
out
year.
There, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the fact is, since that H1N1 has been in the vaccine for the last few years, if you've gotten a shot in the last few years, you might have some protection. But if it's not recent, you might not be as well protected as someone who's just gotten the shot.
We're talking about flu season with Dr. Ann Thomas at the Oregon Public Health Division. She's a public health physician in the acute and communicable disease section. And you can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number is 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Connie in Eugene, welcome to the exchange.
Good morning. Thanks for the program. I have a question. Most of my friends are in the baby boomer generation, and I have three people that I know within a small group that have gotten not the flu, but an extremely intense upper respiratory infection that goes directly into a deep cough and seems to affect them for weeks. And I wondered if there's some kind of parallel virus that's circulating, and has this also produced either pneumonia patients or other people that are filling hospitals as well?
All right.
Thank
good
you.
Question. Thanks for that.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's hard to say because there are literally, you know, dozens of different respiratory viruses, so it's hard to know which one is causing this illness in your friends. And if they've all had sort of similar symptoms, it's probably, you know, it's probably a single virus that's circulating among your friends. And it's hard because it's not really standard of care to test people when they have what appears to be, you know, a viral infection. because it won't respond to antibiotics, so there's no reason to run up, you know, charges or, you know, use up resources when the advice will typically be the same. So it's hard to know, to respond to, like, what's the risk of pneumonia or something, because without really knowing what the particular virus is. But certainly there are other viruses, and I think that's one of the things that sort of separates other viruses from flu, is that flu is very intense, and generally people have to stay put, but it generally resolves in about a week or so. And certainly there are other viruses, and I had one last fall where I had a cough for 3 weeks.
But it was not flu.
Typically not. I think oftentimes the difference is flu pretty much always presents with a fever, and flu is very sudden. You get up and you eat your breakfast and you go to work and you're fine, and then at lunchtime you are not fine. you must go home.
You are suddenly not fine.
Yeah.
Yes.
Whereas I think most times when you have things that we typically refer to as cough, cold, other viruses, it can kind of be a few days coming on where you're not feeling quite right, and then maybe a few days of you might feel like you need some rest. But it's usually more that frustration of having the cough that nags at you for a long time.
Another question here via email. Debbie in Talent wants to know, if you had the H1N1 strain in 2009, can you get it again this year? Would it have mutated enough?
No, that's very interesting. So if the fact is, it's hard to know, you know, if they really had the flu in 2009 and, you know, saw a clinician and were tested, then you actually probably are pretty safe. And that was one of my questions when I first heard that the strain circulating this year was the H1N1, it's like, oh, I wonder if it's just mutated enough that more people are susceptible now. And the fact is, from what I've talking to people at CDC, it appears to be a very stable virus, which again is unusual for flu, and it hasn't mutated enough. So you probably do have immunity. However, we always, in those situations, we always do tell people to get a shot, because the shot also contains the H3N2 virus. And depending on which kind, they'll often cover both strains of the B virus that circulates, because those could still come out this year. And typically, oftentimes, a pattern that you do see is that you'll have an A year at the first part of the year, like we're having now, and then sometimes at the tail end of the year, you'll start seeing cases of the B type. So I would still recommend getting a shot.
So how many different strains are addressed by one inoculation?
Typically, it's always been, in the last several years, it's been three. You'll get an H1N, they'll try and predict each year what's going to circulate, and they'll include an H1N1 strain, an H3N2 strain, and then a B virus. Now, the B, and it's interesting because those A ones, they're around for a couple of years, and they go away. B is actually quite fascinating. There have been two strains that have been in circulation for the last 30 to 40 years, and they seem to just toggle back and forth each year very unpredictably. And so it's not been uncommon in the last, few decades where, since it takes 6 months to produce flu vaccine, you have to make the decision, like in February or March, which one you're going to put in your vaccine. So, WHO and CDC will make the decision. They'll put it in, and then they'll be caught flat-footed, and it'll be the other B strain. So now they've developed vaccines that are called quadrivalent, so they carry four strains. And so some of the vaccines that are available this year now contain both strains of B.
Does the intensity of a particular strain of the flu include an ability to transmit more easily?
Right. So that's another thing is, and that's a great thing that separates what we call the seasonal flu, or the H1 that's circulating now, from these more pathogenic strains that you hear about in Asia, the H5N1 and now the H7N9. And the things about those, they really are what we'd call virulent or pathogenic, where the mortality rate is very high, sometimes in excess of 50%. And so, but those don't seem to be transmitted very well. So those are some of the different sort of kind of genetic sort of strategies that you see with a flu virus, if you will, is that some seem to be very virulent but aren't transmitted as easily. And it seems that the ones that are more easily transmitted tend to be not as virulent. But that was the fear in 2009, is that at first, the first few cases seemed very mild. There were reports of some children in Southern California that had this new strain that had never been seen before. But it seems to spread very easily, and you're never sure that, how stable is this virus, and could it mutate and become more virulent and spread as easily as a typical season flu. And so far, we haven't seen anything like that, fortunately.
It seems like every year when we talk about influenza, we also have to ask about what people tend to refer to as the stomach flu. If you are vomiting or have diarrhea or some other intestinal distress, is that anything to do with influenza?
No, I think that's typically something called the norovirus, which is a gastrointestinal virus. And I think over the years, clinicians have referred to it as the stomach flu, just because I think in general, people understand that the flu is a virus and that you don't get antibiotics and it just has to take its course. And so similarly, this gastrointestinal virus, which is norovirus, is also something that you know, you acquire it and you're usually sick for a day or two and it gets better by itself. And so I think clinicians or people have referred to it as the stomach flu, but it's a distinctly separate virus.
As far as preventive techniques, in addition to getting a vaccine, and you say there's still time to get a vaccine, it will take 2 weeks to get to reach full effectiveness, but begins to work right away. The hand washing and the use of hand sanitizers, how effective really are those at keeping people from spreading the flu?
I think they're very important. I think the other thing that I like to push is the formal strategy is called social distancing. But I sort of call it a common sense approach of you just should stay home when you're sick. And I think particularly this year where the groups that seem to be hit hardest are really working age adults. And so I think employers should be sympathetic and really encourage people to stay home if they're sick and not spread it to others. I think we've all been in a position where we've been in a meeting where someone is coughing and saying, oh, I shouldn't be here, but I couldn't miss this meeting. And then you get sick.
Mm-hmm. All right, a sharp upswing certainly in flu cases over the last 3 reported weeks in the state of Oregon. We'll keep an eye on the rest of flu season. Dr. Ann Thomas is with the Oregon Public Health Division, public health physician in the acute and communicable disease section. Thank you so much for joining us again, Dr. Thomas.
Oh, my pleasure.
I'll do it for this segment of the Jefferson Exchange. A short break and then back with Garrison Keillor.